downed power line started one of two fires yesterday. Good evening, I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about Governor Steve Bullock's new early childhood education program. And in tonight's feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with a Buddha relic tour manager about the historical Buddha relics that are visiting Missoula and their significance in the Buddhist faith. A downed power line started a fire near Clinton in the Bear Mouth area east of Missoula. The Nimron fire ignited last night around 6 p.m. and has initial attack crews on the site. The fire near Clinton, north of Interstate 90, is now 350 acres. Department of Natural Resources and Conservation spokeswoman Cindy Super says a red flag warning went into effect this afternoon with winds pushing 20 miles per hour. She says those winds are pushing east, away from homes along Interstate 90.
You know, it's primarily grass. In there is some timber, there's less timber, perhaps than there may have been. But, you know, grass is a flashy fuel and things happen quickly and it does burn and reacts quickly to things like hot, dry, windy days.
She says the plan is to contain the fire with air and ground resources. A public information meeting will be held tonight at 7 p.m. at Bear Mouth Chalet RV Park in Clinton. Another fire started yesterday 15 miles south of Slowey Campground in Superior Ranger District on the Lolo National Forest. The freeze-out fire grew to 14 acres today in heavy timber and was likely caused by a lightning holdover. Fire managers plan to focus on handline construction, get water and hoses to the fire line, and maintain firefighter safety because of numerous snags in the fire area.
And another news from around the state, an appeals court won't reconsider a ruling allowing political parties to endorse candidates and make expenditures in Montana's nonpartisan judicial elections. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals today denied the Montana Attorney General's petition for a rehearing by the entire court of a three-judge panel's June ruling. The panel said the state's ban on party endorsements and expenditures in judicial races is unconstitutional, but said candidates can't receive direct contributions from parties. The state asked for a rehearing, calling it a matter of exceptional importance in Montana's authority to determine how to maintain an impartial and nonpartisan judiciary. The Ninth Circuit denied the petition after no judge requested a vote to rehear the matter. Attorney General spokesman John Barnes did not immediately return a call for comment.
Three former employees of the Crow Tribe's Historic Preservation Office have been convicted in a federal corruption case in which prosecutors said $500,000 was stolen from the tribe in a double billing scheme by workers who monitored commercial projects to make sure they didn't harm archaeologically or historically important areas on the reservation. The Billings Gazette reports jurors today found Dale Oldhorn, his son Alan Oldhorn, and Sean Talking Eagle Danforth guilty of conspiracy, mail fraud, theft from an organization receiving federal funds, and theft from a tribal organization. The jury also convicted Alan Oldhorn of extortion and income tax fraud. U.S. District Judge Sam Haddon scheduled sentencing for December 10th in Helena and ordered all three men into custody. The trial began Monday.
Governor Steve Bullock is looking to put more focus into early childhood education, that is, education before a kid is 5 years old. Bullock says Montana ranks near the bottom of states in investment in early ed. However, state spending did increase this past legislative session by nearly $2.5 million. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says that money will go toward increasing a ranking program for daycare centers called the Best Beginnings Stars to Quality Program.
What color is that black?
Green.
Green.
Yes.
Yes.
Green. Caterpillar Corner, spelled with two K's. It's a Helena daycare center. Owner Amanda Hatch runs it out of her home.
Yellow.
The older kids are out on a walk with one of her employees. Hatch is working one-on-one with two-year-old Maya, constructing a makeshift house with different colored foam blocks, learning through play.
Sitting down with a kid and making them count and things like that is not as effective as, hey, I've got a red block. You know, what can we build with the red block?
Caterpillar Corner is one of about 75 businesses participating in the state's Best Beginnings Stars to Quality program. It's a ranking system, a five-star ranking system. Businesses in the program receive their star number based on the amount of training employees have, the environment they create for kids, their business model. The state gives participants money every quarter for being in the program, the amount increasing with a higher star level. Caterpillar Corner receives nearly $1,400 a quarter now as a Star 3 facility. Amanda Hatch has been in the program since it started in 2010, and she says earning those three stars was not easy.
It took me 2 years before I even applied for a three. The training is long.
Each star level requires greater training, more state oversight. There's only one five-star facility in the state, in Whitefish. The Department of Public Health and Human Services runs the Stars to Quality program. Human and Community Services Division Administrator Jamie Pelagi says science continues to put a greater emphasis on the importance of more sophisticated education early on.
The capacity to learn is really formulated in the first years of life, and then after that, we're strengthening what's happened in our brain during that early development.
Pelagi says Stars to Quality training puts a lot of focus on social, emotional development.
How do you make friends? How do you feel about yourself? How do you handle anger? How can you handle situations?
For instance, Amanda Hatch at Caterpillar Corner uses a story called Tucker Turtle to teach kids about anger management. When kids are mad, she has them pretend they are Tucker Turtle and has them hide under a sleeping bag and take three deep breaths to calm down. This transitions up to literacy development and numbers to help kids better prepare for preschool or kindergarten later. The program is now growing due to $2.5 million from the legislature. Jamie Pelagi with DPHHS says the state is seeing improved outcomes from kids in Stars to Quality facilities, but the program is still in its pilot phase. Pelagi says the state will be taking a few more years to figure out what works best for businesses and for children. She says this may translate down the line to benchmarks child care providers have to meet in Montana, not just voluntary ones.
Where's your nose? Where's your ears?
Amanda Hatch says Stars to Quality has made her feel more confident in what she does.
The person I was before I started is not the person I am now.
Helping her experience that part of the job she finds most rewarding. When the light bulb goes on and something finally clicks with a kid.
When they finally get a skill or, you know, they share without yanking out of the hand saying, mine, you know, things like that.
She's applying for her four-star ranking this fall. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Where's your belly? Where's your belly? Belly!
Last week, the Western Montana Fair descended upon Missoula's fairgrounds for the 134th time. Along with the food, rides, and games, there were animals and lots of them. The Glacier Ice Rink and adjoining structures provided a temporary home for about 500 critters of all sizes. Many were reared by families involved in Montana's largest out-of-school youth development program, 4-H. Dressed in sharp black pants and crisp white shirts, 4-H'ers presented their animals as well as in-depth knowledge of their characteristics. Reporter Justin Steck visited with participants of the event.
There's basically two different types of competition. Showmanship, where the exhibitors, the kids, are judged on their skills as a showman, how well they present their animal to the judge. And then there are the confirmation classes, which is judging how well the animal is put together, basically, against a standard, you know, an ideal animal for that particular species.
Missoula County 4-H Extension Agent Campbell Barrett was tasked with turning an ice rink into a livestock pavilion, which is no small feat. With several 4-H activities held before the start of the fair, preparations for him began July 20th. Barrett was the only 4-H employee putting in a full week at the fair, which means club volunteers and parents are responsible for much of the grunt work. He puts their contribution into perspective.
Thousands of volunteer hours put into setting this thing up and running the show. At the national estimate of $18 per volunteer hour, we're putting hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of free labor into pulling this thing off for the county. So
kids today can find numerous programs in 4-H that promote hands-on learning, from computers to cooking. But in Montana, a big part of 4-H is agriculture. In the early 1900s, one goal of the association was to introduce new technologies to youth who would hopefully then convince their elders there was benefits to agricultural innovation. Today, it's often the parents who encourage their children to get involved. Father of two 4-H'ers, Tim Morin, says parents have their reasons.
The parents, I think, have their own set of motivations for getting kids to do things, and hopefully, in theory, we try to get them to take on some responsibilities.
That word responsibility was used by parents and kids alike. Some kids avoid responsibility at all costs, but not the 4-H members I talked with. Dedication to their animals and camaraderie with their fellow members made them proud. Many families have 4-H in their blood. Morin's family has been involved for generations. The same can be said for Jeff Wilson's family. He hinted that he had a part in his two sons' participation. They were showing poultry, heifers, and steers. Wilson believes there's great value in their 4-H education.
It's a year-round commitment. None of this happens easily. It's amazing how much better things go when you work at it and keep at it and are very persistent. We're talking about 24/7, basically, which is also the grounds that built America.
Brooms and shovels were constantly used to keep the hay, wood shavings, and animal droppings in their place. Stalls displayed each animal's name and owner and often were adorned with decorations. One cow was named College Fund, a reminder that the market animals are sold at the fair's end. 8-year 4-H veteran Lisha Wiley talks about the future for her market lamb.
On Thursday, the judge places you in order of best lamb to worst lamb meat-wise, and bidders just bid, and hopefully you get the best price you can.
Wiley says the most difficult moment comes a few days later.
The really hard day is Sunday when the truck comes to take them away, because each lamb after the auction, they get a mark on their back, and depending on the color of the mark, it tells you if they're going to be slaughtered or bred or just bought for a pet or whatever.
A difficult lesson, but just one of many lessons when rearing animals. Maria McAvoy didn't require any prodding to get into 4-H. For her, it was a logical step.
I have a lot of animals, just to begin with, and I thought that just be a great way to kind of like involve myself in something more than just everyday stuff.
She and her goat, Maxine, were having a successful Tuesday morning.
I got the grand champion for Nigerian Dwarf, and then we brought all the grand champions for all of the different breeds, and I won grand champion for those.
Shane Parrish knows the feeling of claiming grand champion. Last year, he kept his family's 4-H success alive.
My family has won Grand or Reserve here for the last 20 years. But last year, I was just super psyched because I wasn't expecting it at all. I thought I was kind of sloppy with it, but won Grand Champion Showmanship.
The patience displayed by the youngsters when showing their animals was impressive. Domesticated doesn't necessarily mean tame. The least cooperative of the bunch seemed to be the pigs. Getting them into the weighing pen was another event where teamwork was on showcase. Whenever any animal gained freedom from their owner's grasp, bystanders would jump to action and quickly corral the runaway. On the other end of the spectrum were the rabbits. First-year 4-H'er Abby Risco's rabbit was out of control during her competition. It was supposed to be posing side view for the judge. Instead, its front paws stretched up Abby's chest and gave what looked like bunny kisses. Abby's mom and dad are thrilled with her participation in the program. Vicki Risca thinks the program will benefit her daughter for years to come.
It's lifelong skills. It's not just about the animals. It's about life. It's about how to prepare yourself. So I think it's something that it's amazing. I never did it as a kid, and I wish I would have, because I'm learning right along with her.
The Risca said they think they're in 4-H for the long haul. From the families I met, that could mean their next several generations will be members. From Montana Public Radio, I'm Justin Steck.
Governor Steve Bullock and company officials are lauding the state's first production carbon dioxide injection oil field as a big step forward. Officials with Denbury Resources Incorporated held a ribbon cutting today at their Bell Creek plant in southeastern Montana. The company said it has invested more than $300 million in an effort to receive a 1960s era oil field. Carbon dioxide is piped to the plant from coal operations in Wyoming and pumped underground to force out more oil. Bullock said the technology is good for the environment by capturing the greenhouse gases and good for the economy by bringing more jobs and tax base to the state. The company said it already has plans for an even larger recovery project on the Montana and North Dakota border.
A tour of historical Buddha relics is making its first visit to Missoula this weekend. The free exhibit is being held at the Missoula College of the University of Montana. It's the only Montana stop on the tour. In this evening's feature interview, Buddha Relic Tour Manager Amanda Russell explains the significance of these ancient relics and adherents of the Buddhist faith. First, though, she offers this brief explanation of basic tenets of Buddhism.
The basic tenets of Buddhism is loving kindness and loving compassion and cultivating inner development. So when we're speaking universally about Buddhism, it's more about our progression of our inner world so that we can be peaceful and that reflects in our outer world.
Boy, that sounds difficult.
Not too difficult. It's mindfulness. Every day, waking up, just thinking like, okay, how am I going to start the day? What's the first thought of the day? You know, I want to be kind to everybody that I meet. I'm going to try my best today to be more patient while I'm driving. You know, I'm going to say hello to everybody at the office with a big smile on my face. You know, just these simple things are cultivating mindfulness and can go a very long way. Yeah, so things like that.
How did you get tied into this this tour of these relics?
Well, I actually got tied into the tour because I volunteered. I actually did the flower arrangements for this, not knowing anything about Buddhist relics or Buddhism. And yeah, it took my heart. It was such a profound experience for me. It changed my entire life. It was one of those, kind of sounds cliche coming from the manager, but really the relics changed my life. I ended up finding a Dharma center or an FPMT center, and I started studying Buddhist philosophy, cultivating my mind, changing my attitudes and beliefs. In that, I found that myself was happy. I was more happy in my everyday life because of that transformation, because I could see it in myself. It just made me want to learn more, and that's how I found these Buddha relics. So,
and what are these Buddhist relics?
These relics come from masters of highly realized or highly conscious beings. So if everyone's familiar with Buddha Shakyamuni or Gautama Buddha, Prince Siddhartha, the historical Buddha that we read about in our textbooks, we have relics from 2,500 years ago, and these are crystal-like pearls that come from the cremation ashes or the remains of an enlightened being. Basically, they're not parts of the body. They literally look like little pearls. We call them in Tibetan ring cells, and they say they're said to hold the qualities of the mind is because these great meditators spend their life cultivating equanimity, you know, a non-dual state. They come to this point of unconditional love. They're usually going into, you know, a three-year retreat, cultivating the mind. Now, today, Stanford and Harvard will study monks that have meditated over 10,000 hours because then they see structural and functional differences in their brain.
And some of these pieces, they have quite the history. I mean, some of these relics are from the Dalai Lama's collection in particular?
Yeah. His Holiness the Dalai Lama he offered a relic of Buddha Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, from his collection. And so that's a 2,600-year-old relic. And he's also one of our main teachers.
What's the history of this tour?
Well, it's really interesting because usually Buddhist relics are kept in a temple or a stupa, we call it, or some sacred statue in India, Asia, Thailand, Cambodia, etc. And people make pilgrimage to these sacred sites. Or either that they're a collection of a high lama and they're kept private, you know, because they are so profound and they are so precious. But because of the kindness of Lama Zopa Rinpoche and because of the kindness of his teacher, Lama Yeshe, they had this vision of sharing this with the world, knowing that people can't always go on pilgrimage to see these. The benefit that they bring is so profound. They say, you know, it's just amazing to have to be in the presence of these relics. It's so profound that they wanted to share it with the world. So they started this tour 11 years ago from the ground up. Well, Lama Zopa did, because Lama Yeshe passed away in 84, and he completed the vision. Our director, Victoria Coleman, actually started this 11 years ago from the ground up, and not really knowing, you know, how it would unfold, she started taking relics and creating small exhibitions in different cities. And now we've been to 67 countries. Over 1.8 million people have viewed the relics. And we've been in every continent except for Antarctica. So over the 11 years, people have really just been so moved. And we travel all by generosity. So this is a nonprofit. We don't charge to come. You tell us you want us to come to your city, we come. And we run solely off donations. And it's been working that way for 11 years.
Tell us about the layout of this display. What does it look like?
Basically, you know, we set up a traditional Tibetan-style altar because most of these masters are Tibetan, and so we have a Buddha, Maitreya, in the center, and the reason why we honor Maitreya is because Maitreya in Sanskrit means loving-kindness, and this is the loving-kindness tour. So we have Maitreya in the center.
And you say Maitreya, what does that look like?
It's a typical Buddha statue, so it looks like a typical, you know, Buddha, except for this Maitreya is sitting Western style, so his both feet are on the ground instead of him being in lotus, because he's predicted to be, you know, the next Buddha to come, which I find funny that he's actually been depicted in the past pictures as sitting Western style, because that's more traditional to our era. You know, very rarely we see people sitting in lotus unless, you know, they're doing yoga or meditation. We sit in chairs most of the time. So It's a big golden statue, and we have him in the center. And then around him, we have many, many offerings, and we have flowers and candles and water bowls and incense. And we offer these not because this Buddha that we're worshiping. We're offering this to the great sages of the past, the great yogis of the past that devoted their lives to meditation and cultivating the mind and inner peace. Because when they would give their life up, they would rely heavily on the people. We would offer them water to drink, water to bathe, food to eat, incense and perfume along their travels. And so today, symbolically, we still offer those on our altar. And it's also a form of generosity, knowing that when we die, we're not going to take the things that we covet with us. So we offer those in remembering that, the freedom to give to anybody that is in need is so profound, knowing that we are not going to take this wealth with us. So why not share it?
And what's the schedule for this weekend's visit here in Missoula?
We are going to be here for today, Saturday, and Sunday, and we are open today from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., and Saturday we are open from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., and Sunday we are open 11 a.m. to 6 p.m., and we will be at the Missoula College of the University of Montana, which is the Health and Business Building. And it's room HB01 at 909 South Avenue West.
And again, this is a free event. After Missoula, where are you off to next, or is this the only stop in Montana?
This is the only stop in Montana, so this is the only time. Then we'll be headed to Denver, Colorado, and then that clear across east to Davenport, Iowa, and then up into Canada. So this might be your one and only chance to get to see them this year. It's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Like I said, there's over 1,000 relics in this collection. It's very rare to even be able to see one relic in your lifetime. Even if you do travel to Asia or Thailand or Cambodia, usually you only get to see one, if that. Sometimes it's far away.
All right. Amanda Russell of the Tour of the Historical Buddha Relics, thanks so much for spending some time with us today, and best of luck on your tour.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And in tonight's weather forecast for west of the Divide, tonight expect partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 40s to mid-50s. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a slight chance of thunderstorms with highs in the 80s. Sunday calls for mostly clear skies with a slight chance of rain showers. Highs are expected to be in the 80s. For central Montana, tonight look for mostly clear skies with slight chance of thunderstorms. Lows will be in the upper 50s. Tomorrow will be sunny in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be around 80 to 90 degrees. Sunday calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be around 75 to 85 degrees. And for southwest Montana, tonight expect mostly clear skies with lows in the lower 50s. Tomorrow will be sunny in the morning, then becoming partly cloudy. There's a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening with highs around 80 to 90 degrees. Sunday calls for partly cloudy skies with a slight chance of showers and thunderstorms. Highs will be around 75 to 85 degrees. Currently in our listening area, Helena is 97 degrees with windy conditions. In Kalispell, it's fair and 90 degrees. Butte has 90 under sunny skies. Great Falls is fair with 99 degrees. Here in Missoula, the temperature under fair skies is 91 degrees. It's 91 and fair in Dillon. In Hamilton, it's sunny and 93 degrees. Libby has 84 with partly cloudy conditions. And in Polson, skies are fair and it's 92 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Kate Holova.
Drugs in prisons hit the news cycle this week with the force of a coordinated campaign. New York City's stop-and-frisk policy was found unconstitutional, and we learned that the NSA shares intercepted information with the DEA to use against American citizens. It is the DEA's policy, then, to make up stories to cover up how they got their leads. The White House threw down on Monday. In a speech before the American Bar Association, Attorney General Eric Holder announced new White House policy in regards to mandatory minimums for low-level drug offenders. Holder recognized the destructive impact of mandatory minimums on minority communities and pointed to the need for alternative placements or rehab for some of these offenders. Such programming is likely to be helpful for some, and recognition of the destructiveness of mandatory minimums is nothing less than welcome. Yet, Holder's remarks were met by advocates for change in drug and prison policies with lukewarm praise and limp-handed applause. Alternative sentences and rehab still frame the issue as a matter of addressing bad behavior rather than a matter of addressing bad laws. It offers new ways to contend with too many misbehaving citizens rather than ways to curb economic drivers for locking citizens up. Figures from this week's Economist. America has around 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's prisoners. Roughly one in every 107 American adults is behind bars, a rate nearly five times that of Britain, seven times that of France, and 24 times that of India. According to Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project, these numbers show no proven relation to crime rates. In the coverage of Holder's remarks, several reporters framed those remarks as addressing the problem of overcrowded prisons. But the problem isn't overcrowded prisons, but an overcriminalized culture structured to create crowded prisons. That crowd in a crowded prison is an industry resource for the for-profit incarceration machine. It's not that hard to figure out. Create a for-profit government contractor whose profits derive from the number of prisoners served. A portion of that profit is reinvested in creating more profit through political lobbying, just like any industry. Successful lobbying means more prisoners, which means more resources, which means more political power, which means more resources. And when I say resources, I mean taxpayer dollars. It's a self-reinforcing loop, not unique to the prison industry. The system may not be predatory on purpose, but it is predatory by design. Holder didn't mention for-profit prisons as a driver of obscene incarceration rates. What Holder said the administration will do is instruct federal prosecutors to write up reports on low-level drug offenders in such a way so as to not trigger mandatory minimums. This direction to federal prosecutors is what's called a policy. The Ogden memo of 2009 was also a federal policy suggesting that federal police would take a hands-off approach in regards to state legal medical marijuana providers. But as a federal prosecutor said during the trial of a Montana provider 2 years ago, in reference to the Ogden memo, and I quote, "a policy is not a promise." Federal policy, it turns out, indicates an option the government says to prefer, may exercise, or may exercise selectively. In all fairness, as the executive branch, they lack the power to eliminate mandatory minimums altogether, and there is currently a bipartisan bill in Congress to do just that. On Thursday, the U.S. Sentencing Commission voted unanimously to address concerns with mandatory minimums. The Washington Post quoted this week from a report from the Urban Institute that at the current rate, prisons will eat up 30% of the entire Department of Justice's budget by 2020. Add to this prevailing distrust of government regarding surveillance, concern over an over-militarized police force, and a rising recognition that misinformation justifies the drug war, and the week's news cycle seemed to demonstrate the need to relieve building public pressure. But it would be naive to think protecting profits are not also part of the current calculations. Anchoring it all was science. In a CNN special, Dr. Sanjay Gupta announced that science has changed his mind on marijuana, and he has publicly apologized for failing to recognize its medicinal value. He presents his evidence in his special report, Weed, which can be found on YouTube or at CNN.com. This is Kate Haleva. Thanks for listening.
Kate Haleva is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. Views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetic.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.